modern psychology has shown that, in fact, helping others produces more benefits for yourself than being served. And I'm like, who knew? Who knew other than the modern psychologists? Let me see.
Right. The way that I kind of answer this to create conversation is I'll say yes. And I think everybody is a religious person.
Mm. And see what you did there.
Yeah, see what I did there?
I said, I talked to them about Jesus. And one of the mums sort of looked at me, somewhat disconcerted and said, well, but what about the ones that are Muslims? And I said, I talked to them about Jesus too. I'm Rebecca McLaughlin, and I'm joined by my co-host, Kyle Worley. How's it going in Texas, Kyle?
It is going really well. We had rain for the first time yesterday in, I believe, 44 days.
Wow.
So I literally walked outside my front door and I said, I like shouted, thank you, God, and then just applauded. Not like just to nobody. Just like I was
you
just
literally
like,
shouted, thank you, God,
yes,
into the ether. Is that normal for folks in Texas to do?
Yeah. No, it's not. at least not in any sort of genuine way. I don't think I was genuinely thanking God. It was like the trees of the earth would clap their hands. I was like out there just like, thank you, Lord, for this rain. I was so happy to see my grass getting water. So
that's amazing. Brits are famous for talking about the weather because our weather is so interesting. You don't know what's going to happen day to day within a certain band, though. Mm. I mean, there is not going to be a tornado.
Right.
Or a sudden kind of ice storm.
Sure.
It's going to be very within a certain temperate climate band. But we talk about it a lot because there's a lot happening with our weather. So I'm impressed that you went straight to weather.
I did. I went straight to weather because in my heart of hearts, I'm a Brit.
That's what you would like to tell yourself. I appreciate
that. That is what I would like to tell myself. My brother and I went to London a number of years ago. And we went to all the places you go to when you go to London. And then we took a train, which are very popular there.
Indeed. We love our trains.
We thought it was so crazy that we were getting on a train. We were like, what? And so we took this train to Manchester wearing shorts and a t-shirt. We did not know there's a difference between an express route so we took a train to Manchester on an express route. But later that evening when we were trying to come home, we took a train that stopped at every station between Manchester and London. And we were like, because the train out to Manchester real fast. I mean, it was like it was beautiful. It was like a quick trip. But on the way back, we hit every station. I think it took us, I don't know, something like 6 hours.
And were many drunk people coming off the train at various
100%.
Points?
Yeah, I was blown away. So I felt like I had some real British street cred after that experience. It was like, I took a train to Manchester from London and felt very, we felt very, acclimated. We weren't knighted or anything, but.
Disappointing.
It
My
is.
In-laws are from Oklahoma, and the first time they visited me and Brian in England, we went on a train together.
Okay.
And Brian had talked to them so much about not being the sort of stereotypical loud American in England. Because Americans just on average speak more loudly than Brits do. I don't know what the deal is there, but it's true. They were terrified of this. And so we got on a train and we were in one of those carriages called the quiet carriage. Did you come across those?
No.
A quiet carriage means don't talk on your phone in this carriage. It doesn't mean like have no conversation whatsoever at a reasonable volume with people around you. It means don't be like, I'm on the train, I'll be there in 15 minutes, which is what Brits do all day long on the train.
Okay.
So my sweet mother-in-law was sitting on this train and she's literally whispering to me, do you see that outside the window? What's going on? I was like, it's okay. You can talk. This is not like the silent carriage where you will be escorted off the train for being the loud American who talked at all. But I had to persuade her into that.
I love that. I love that for an American, it was basically like quiet effectively meant whisper. Like for an American, it's like you've got normal, which is decibel breaking loud. And then you've got quiet, which is like, I got to whisper about this right now.
Indeed. It was an on-off switch, but they have been well-trained now. Here's one of the differences that I've observed between the UK and the US. I've lived here 14 years now. It seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, that America in general is more religious than the UK. This seems to be true sort of both data-wise and anecdotally. You are more likely to encounter a highly religious person in the US than the UK. And especially, I guess, where you are in Texas versus even where I am in Cambridge, Massachusetts, there's a lot of religion going on.
Yeah, it feels that way. Sometimes when you make these observations, I wonder, do you feel like Alexis de Tocqueville? Do you feel like you're like... Do you feel like you're the international outsider who's come in with like the disinterested observation and you're like, the American experiment is, you know, is a, an endeavor towards failure at an impossibly slow rate? I mean, like, do you just feel like, do you feel, let me, I'm going to get to your question. Do you feel distant enough? I mean, you've been here for a long time and like you dove in with both feet. I mean, marrying a guy from Oklahoma, that's basically like, I mean, you went right into the middle of America.
Yeah. A real American. Is what Americans always said to me. Oh, you married a real American. I'm like, oh yeah.
So do you still feel detached in that way to like ask a question like, do you feel like you're asking a question of yourself? Do you feel like I'm asking a question of the American experience of which I now feel very enmeshed? Or does it still feel like, do you still feel like you're walking around as an outside observer?
I think I still feel something of an outside observer. I think part of the reason for that is that a lot of my friends here are actually from other places.
Yeah.
You know, our community group has a lot of immigrants one way or another, whether from Nigeria or Iran or Singapore. And so that I'm alongside a lot of other people who are looking at American experience from a somewhat outsider's perspective. Mm-hmm. And then a number of my American friends here will have reflected on, you know, that they've had enough conversations with people from different cultural backgrounds to be reflecting themselves on things that might feel instinctive to Americans that don't feel instinctive to other people. So I think I've got both of those things at play. I don't want to sound, I worry that I may sound like the kind of snooty Brit who comes over here and thinks she knows what she's talking about. And there are particular things, I mean, for example, conversations about race in America, I've worked hard to try to actually educate myself somewhat because I know many of my initial instincts are just going to be off.
Yeah,
you know, this is not where I grew up. I don't, there are many things that I'm going to make stupid mistakes that even somebody with my same kind of background, but in the US may not have made. So I don't think it's just a hubristic, snooty, let me tell you what I'm seeing here approach. I hope there's a dose of humility in there. But it's fascinating having grown up sort of spiritually in the UK and been part of a much smaller evangelical ecosystem with both the positives and the negatives of that. It's then interesting relating to the US where evangelical identification is even, you know, goes well beyond people who actually have a deep faith in Jesus. And that's something I'm still getting my head around. I still have to be reminded. My friend Rachel often has to remind me that a lot of people in America who would say they are evangelicals and may even be able to sort of articulate something of what that might mean are in fact not Christians at all and may not even have any like active participation in any church. It's just that there's a kind of cultural thing that in the UK doesn't really exist. So I'm still learning that.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't traveled enough or spent enough time outside of the country to know, but to your original question, does America feel more religious? It certainly seems to me to be a place, and particularly where I live. I mean, I live in Texas. And you know, yeah, it feels more ruggedly religious, just like very like, it's something that is, even if it's not the substance of any conversation you're having in America, it hangs like a specter.
Right.
Like, even if it's not what you're talking about, you could be talking about culture or food or politics or music or art or film. And in America, that conversation always feels like it is just, even if it's not about religion, it's like very adjacent to that conversation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's how everything feels all the time.
When you're talking in your kind of context in Texas, when you're talking with someone who is not a Christian and may not even identify as sort of religious in any way, would you say their perception of religion in general, religious people in particular, is generally positive or generally negative?
Well, that's changing. I mean, even in Texas, it's changing. I would imagine that some other parts of the country have experienced this already. If you'd asked me that 10 years ago, 13 years ago, when I was beginning my life in vocational ministry, I would have said, yeah, I mean, if you ask somebody, even if they're not religious, they're not antagonistic. They're not hard about it. It just kind of, there's an indifference. And then I felt like we hit a peak where with the new atheism, where it was like, it almost kind of like valorized and glorified a kind of like militancy around anti-religious sentiment broadly. Certainly that was felt. Our Muslim neighbors felt that very quickly. I mean, that was not like a 2010s thing for them.
Yeah.
Post 2001, they felt an anti-religious sentiment that, you know, Western Christians were not experiencing anywhere near the same degree. But so I would say, I bet my Muslim neighbors would answer this question very differently. But as a Christian, I felt like there was, for most of my life in following Jesus here, if somebody was not a Christian, they weren't antagonistic towards the idea of religion broadly. Or Christianity specifically. Then I felt like from around 2004, 5, 6, 7, there was a rise in like all religion is bad. It's only going to create damage. And that rhetoric was so pronounced and it was given such a huge megaphone that it kind of glorified that line of – or that way of talking about religion. And then I feel like it's – but I feel like it's faded again.
Interesting.
So where I'm at now, if I meet somebody, they might feel that – like what I'll hear two things. One, most people that are non-Christians or are not religious in any meaningful way, Christian or not, there's a profound indifference. Just like a – like, oh, yeah, whatever kind of vibe to it.
Because they've been there and done that or
– I think it's because
– it just doesn't interest them.
I think they don't find it persuasive. But they've accepted it, especially in the South, they've accepted it as a kind of like, this is a piece, like this is something you just got to put up with. Like if you don't want to, like, you know, honestly, I have a neighbor who's like, if you don't want to pay state income tax and you want good property value, you got to just endure the fact that people around you are going to be religious. That's what he told me.
Right.
So it's like, and I think a lot of people in like a lot of religiously unengaged people in Texas, but in the South generally, and maybe across the country broadly. I don't know. I think there's just kind of a sense of like, we like living here. We don't really want anything to do with religion. We'll be polite about it as long as you don't make it a sticking point.
Yeah, I was curious when you were talking a few minutes ago about the change that you saw in like the, you know, 2005, 6, 7, 8 kind of range. I was thinking of Christopher Hitchens' book, God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. And just that title, that messaging, which is in some generalized sense, both politically and even just psychologically, religion is bad for you. And we would all be better off if we personally weren't religious and if our society in general was less religious. Do you think those kinds of new atheist tomes were driving how people were thinking around you
absolutely. Yeah, I mean, whether it was the God delusion or, you know, it was the end of religion or it was God Is Not Great, you know, those books were bestsellers and they were all over the talk shows. And, you know, you think about somebody like a Hitchens. I mean, you can say what you want about Christopher Hitchens, but that man was a compelling speaker. His rhetorical skills were significant. And so anytime he had a mic in front of him, and this was also too, like, this is the beginning of content for internet consumption around that time. I mean, like, there was stuff out there, but it had been blogs and zines and, you know, very informal stuff that wasn't very compelling in its format. But like 2005, 2006, 2007, you have YouTube. And now it's like you can see Christopher Hitchens give a talk at Columbia University on God is not great. And that, you know, those kinds of, that ability to transmit that information, I think it moved very quickly.
Yeah.
And, you know, nobody can test that the internet is useful in spreading ideas. But at that moment, some of the big ideas that were front and center from public intellectuals or that kind of strata of authorship, it was, those were the big ideas that were out there.
Yeah. So here's what I think is super ironic about that reality and the impact that the New Atheists had with that particular message is that they really hung their hats, and I guess still do, you know, the Hitchens obviously no longer with us, but you know, the Richard Dawkinses and the Sam Harrises really hung their hats on sort of scientific and empirical evidence.
Right.
And their argument was, you know, Christianity has been, well, religion in general, I mean, they certainly had no sympathy for Muslim belief either.
Nope.
But let's look at Christianity for a second. You know, Christianity has been disproved, discredited by science, shown to be bad for you. Religion poisons everything, that sort of messaging. What's ironic to me is that in the time period between then and now, there has been a growing mountain of evidence from psychologists and you know, the academic experts on these questions to show that in fact they are simply wrong. That actually religion is profoundly good for people.
And you've mentioned that. You said that or something similar to that a couple episodes ago, and I'm unfamiliar with it. Like, is there some data around like psychological benefits for religion? Because that's not something I've really looked into.
Yeah, there's actually a ton. So there's a guy named Tyler Vanderveel, who's a professor at Harvard School of Public Health just down the street from me here.
Wait, Harvard? I've never heard of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not worth thinking about.
Is that a community, local JUCO community college out there?
Yeah, it's you know, a place that thinks a lot of itself. Well, move on from that. But yeah, so Tyler is a Harvard School of Public Health. He runs the Center for Human Flourishing at Harvard.
Okay.
And his particular research focus is on the mental and physical health benefits of religious participation.
Okay.
And what he and his group have found, and it's not just them, I mean, there are other academics working on this and other places as well, but I'm most familiar with his work, and he's definitely been the leading edge of a lot of this. What he's found is that regular religious participation, so like going to church every week, has measurable positive effects on average on people's, not only their mental health, but actually also their physical health. You know, people live longer if they go to church every week.
Huh.
People are, there was a study done by their group several years ago looking at women in particular, actually. It's a study of nurses. And it showed that people who went to church every week were 5 times less likely to kill themselves than people who never went. So like, Tyler said it is about like regular religious participation is about the most protective thing against suicide that we know of.
Wow.
So the idea that people have that going to church is probably going to be, you know, psychologically damaging for you, or even in particular, they've studied as well, like children. Yeah. You know, is raising your children in the church, Richard Dawkins would say that's a form of child abuse. In actual fact, you are setting them up for better mental and physical health than raising them non-religious. So the if you have an atheist friend who is purely concerned with scientific data, they would have to think really hard about why they're not taking their kids to church. Or, I mean, it's actually that, whereas much of the research has been done on church going in America, because of course the majority of religious folks are Christians rather than Jews or Muslims or Hindus, it's not specific to Christianity. So you could be going to, you know, Jewish religious services every week or Muslim religious gatherings every week. But it is specific to religious participation. It's not just like if you went to the golf club every week and saw the same people to do the same shared activity, it would have the same effect. It doesn't.
I wonder then, Rebecca, how...
Rebecca, not Rachel.
I know. I almost called you Rachel. I'm sorry.
It happens.
You're always name dropping your friend, Rachel.
Someone recently, I gave a talk at a church, and at the end, the pastor stood up and he was like, I really want to thank Rachel for the talk that she just gave. I was like, okay.
Oh, man.
Carry on.
Okay. So, Rebecca. Can I call you Rebecca?
Please. What else would you call me?
I could call you Dr. McLaughlin if you prefer.
That would be super weird.
Okay.
Unless you want me to call you Pastor Kyle.
No. We'll go back to first names. Okay. Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about, like, okay, there were some books that came out that were really influential, that were talking about religion and very, like, religion is not just going to, like, it's not just, like, not true. It's, like... Mm. Directly, it's negative. It's it's hurting. It's it's toxic. It's poisonous. Whatever words you want to use. So there's that body of literature, you know, and certainly that, just to do like a little bit of history of ideas real quick, like a lot of that rhetoric, it feels like, oh, wow. I mean, they were saying something new. They really weren't. You go back to Friedrich Nietzsche, the 20th century, he's making basically the same argument on existentialist grounds that Dawkins and Dennett and Harris and Hitchens make on either political or what they would say scientific, although I think they're being pretty fast and loose with what science entails. So it's not like it was a new argument. We're not trying to say that in the early 2000s, a group of guys got together and wrote some books and they broke ground on an idea that had never been suggested or communicated. And then we found ourselves. But how did this idea that church or religion, religion specifically, how did that become present in kind of the Western imagination? You know, like that religion, because you'll hear things like religion is the cause of so much wars and bloodshed and injustice. You know, religion hurts people. And it's like, okay, but there's, okay, then there's this data over here that says religious practices help people. So what really is the gap then?
Yeah, and it's interesting. Both those statements you made, religion causes wars and religion hurts people, both of those statements are true. It is absolutely the case that there have been religiously motivated wars at various times and points in history and even today. The question is, what are we comparing this to?
Right.
And one of the things that I think we learned in the 20th century and 21st century is sort of still bearing witness to, is that taking religion, which is a very, I mean, I feel like when you talk about religion, you might as well be talking about philosophy. You know, is philosophy good for you or bad for you? Well, it kind of depends which philosophy. But just to buy into that a second, if you take religion out of the equation, how do humans then behave? And if we did a sort of point by point comparison between regimes that are explicitly atheistic and regimes that have been, you know, religiously motivated, we would find even more bloodshed from regimes that are explicitly atheistic. So that then brings us back to the question of like, well, what is wrong? Where are these wars in fact coming from? And I think Christianity has a very compelling answer to that question, which is that they're actually coming out of the human heart. So it's not, you know, religion or non-religion. It's actually sin.
Ever since Jesus' female followers were the first to witness his resurrection, women have been sharing the message of Jesus with those who have never heard it. In his new book, 10 Women Who Changed the World, seminary president Daniel L. Akin tells the stories of 10 women in particular who were called by God to serve as missionaries all across the world. As I've studied missions and read missionary biographies over my lifetime, Akin writes, I've been amazed and inspired by the large number of women who left home, families, comfort and safety in obedience to Jesus and his command to go to the nations with his gospel. Their number is far greater than most realize. You can find out about a handful of these stories in 10 Women Who Changed the World, which is available wherever books are sold.
Yes, I agree with you. And I think that like, one of the things that's a really good way to say it. And I think you're, the way you kicked off of that with like, when you ask the question, is religion good or bad? It's like asking, is philosophy good or bad? Or is or is music good or bad? Mm. Or is, you know, this film good or bad? It like, it kind of depends on what it is, right? Yeah. It's not just like a one size fits all answer, because false bad religion is not good. Mm-hmm. It's not good in that it doesn't accord with what's true, and it's not good in that it doesn't produce good, or it doesn't produce the even the moral rationale or logic for good to be done. And I think that Christianity is compelling in the scope of religious studies because it does give a meaningful account of why there is bad in the world.
Yeah.
It does not try to trivialize that bad. Mm-hmm. It doesn't promise that the bad only can be absolved if you lose yourself, like basically like the total void, embracing right. like the nothingness. Mm-hmm. It doesn't tie the bad to ethnic or cultural partiality. Mm-hmm. Like you don't have to become a part of a specific ethnic or cultural group to become good, which I think is also pretty crucial.
Yeah.
And it gives a meaningful account of how good can be done in the face of bad. And I think those things make it a strong foundation for operating as people who can give an honest accounting of the brokenness of the world, even when that brokenness is tied implicitly or explicitly to its own beliefs. You know, like when brokenness is done in the name of Christianity, Christianity can give an account of like why somebody would do such a thing.
Right. And in fact, the measuring stick with which we judge history, with which we judge religious wars, with which we judge, you know, secular wars as well, is a stick that's been given to us by Christianity. Mm-hmm. You know, who says that genocide is wrong?
Right.
Who says that the strong oppressing the weak is wrong? Like, these are not self-evident truths. These are actually Christian truths that have been kind of woven into the fabric of our thinking by this point, to where we look at things which, you know, in the Roman Empire might have been celebrated as great victories and say, actually, an awful lot of people were slaughtered here and that's terrible.
Right.
That the idea of valuing each person's life, valuing even the lives of our enemies, is something that comes, you know, straight out of Jesus's playbook. I'm curious, so a minute ago, you said something with which I both agree and disagree. You said that religion, like other religions that are in fact untrue, ultimately, you know, false, aren't doing good. They're doing evil in the world. I mean, I'm paraphrasing you, but you said something along those lines.
Okay.
I'd want to qualify that slightly to say, you know, whereas I fully agree, you know, for example, if we're comparing, you know, Christianity with Islam, I fully agree that Islam is actually incorrect when it comes to many of the fundamental questions about God and humanity. Mm-hmm. And certainly there has been and continues to be significant evil done with Islam as a sort of motivating force.
Sure.
However, Islam, like Christianity, is offering humans a big story of who they are in the world. And at least some pieces of that story are in fact true. You know, it's offering a story where there is a creator God.
Sure.
For example, and where we have responsibilities, you know, in light of that, and there are some sort of pieces of social structure proceeding from that. Mm-hmm. And so, whereas I think ultimately, you know, Islam is fundamentally leading people astray, and that is a deep tragedy, and that there are, you know, all sorts of things that are emanating from that in negative ways, it's also not completely surprising to me that somebody who goes to a mosque every week and participates in sort of religious services there may also experience sort of psychological benefits of knowing, even at a very basic level, who they are in the world, where, you know, someone who's completely unplugged from that religious kind of way of thinking and has been taught that they are, you know, purely a free agent unto themselves, and the ultimate good is the pursuit of their own happiness, and that, you know, for example, sex belongs wherever you want to put it rather than in the commitment of marriage, all sorts of ways in which actually the person who is deeply religious, even if not Christianly religious, has an advantage over someone who is, you know, kind of trying to come up with their own sense of meaning and purpose in essentially a void.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good point. I would say that I'm pro supernatural worldviews. I'm pro supernatural worldviews. If you're telling, and it seems like some of the data you've mentioned and some of the data I'm familiar with, which is more limited than what you are, seems to suggest that like when you adopt supernatural worldviews, what we could broadly call religious worldviews, worldviews mm-hmm. that take as either a fundamentally basic belief or something that seems warranted from their experience of the world, that there is something that exists outside of the material universe mm-hmm. and that they are not God.
Yep.
But that there is a God. I'm pro that kind of worldview abounding because I think that materialist conceptions of the universe or what we might call like metaphysically naturalist worldviews, meaning mm-hmm. not just worldviews that say, hey, there is a way that nature works, but worldviews that say there is nothing outside of the natural by which we mean material world.
Yep.
Those worldviews, I think that their entailments, like what they lead to, are scary and mm-hmm. violent and brutal and cruel. And I would say that if you're asking me, all things being equal, do I believe there is a benefit to like supernatural worldviews abounding in the world, whether they're Christian or not? The answer is yes. You know, in some ways, I feel a little bit like what Lewis said, and this is a paraphrase, but like the world might need to be repaganized before it can be re-Christianized. Mm. And I am for people looking at the world around them and going, there is a God and I am not that God.
Right. Like, yeah.
I think that is a good place to be. And it doesn't surprise me that by acknowledging that we are not God, whether we acknowledge that we are not God in a mosque or in a temple, or we acknowledge that we're not God in a Scandinavian sanctuary, wherever we're at, I think that's probably a good acknowledgement. And it's not just probably good for us psychologically, because the pressure of trying to live as God is crushing and leads us to be crushed and to crush. But I think it's probably good for the world.
Yeah, I'd need to sit with that a little because on one level, I agree. On another level, I hate for people to have a placebo when they need the life-saving medicine.
Well, absolutely.
You know, I almost would rather somebody kind of stared into the void and realized quite how bleak the world is when you don't believe there is a God at all. And that drove them to Jesus. Then somebody having a kind of alternative to Christianity that did some of the work that Christianity does, but without giving them any kind of access to saving faith in Christ.
Right.
So I can see, like a more flourishing society on the one hand, but possibly fewer people entering the kingdom of God. I mean, not that we can calculate these things, obviously only the Lord can make those calculations. But I do think, I mean, minimally, for those of our friends who are not Christians and maybe, you know, have bought into some of the new atheist ways new atheist assumptions about the goodness or badness of religion, for them to recognize, oh, actually, that is not where the data points at all. Mm-hmm. I had a funny conversation recently with a friend who's a professor at MIT, and she works in the field of AI and has done some work on depression and how the various ways in which humans can we can think about sort of human flourishing. And she recently had a potential donor kind of sit down with her and say, I really need to hear from you, you know, given the mental health crisis among students and young people today, can you tell me what has been shown scientifically to help? You know, I want to fund something that will actually help young people in this country not kill themselves or not be like deeply depressed and miserable. And my friend sort of took a deep breath and said, well, actually, there's a lot of data to show that going to church every week makes a huge difference to your mental health and you know, lowers your likelihood of suicide, etc. And this woman kind of looked back at her and was like, anything else. Because from her perspective, and I feel it, from her perspective as somebody who deeply cares about the mental health of young people and who has a deeply held belief that there must be a secular solution to the problems that we're seeing emerging today, for her to hear, well, actually, if you just want to take an honest look at the scientific data, the more people are religious, the better for their mental and physical health. She doesn't want to hear that. It's like sort of sleeping with the enemy.
No, I mean, I think, how far are you in Clara and the Sun? I know we're both reading this book right now.
Yeah, I'm 25% of the way through. I'm reading another, I'm reading like a theological book in the morning and a novel in the evening, amongst the other responsibilities I have to my 4-year-old, et cetera. So my progress is slow.
Well, of course. Well, the only reason I say that is because as the book progresses, this is part of the question it's asking is like, what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be well? Like, what does it mean to like live a life and that's fully alive? And, you know, it plays around with artificial intelligence as well. I mean, that's kind of part of the book. But it's had me kind of asking the same question, which is just like, it does seem that there are, and we shouldn't be surprised as Christians, if God's word is true, and it is, we shouldn't be surprised when we find our lives stepping into congruence broadly with it, that there is, we experience a benefit. Now, that's not to say that the only reason to live as a Christian is because of the subjective benefits of that experience. That's not what Rebecca's saying. That's not what I'm saying. Jesus Christ is Lord over all, whether we experience subjective benefits from that reality or not. But you will, though. See that? Like, so it's like, while that's not like the thing, while it's not like, okay, following Jesus is going to yield to positive subjective experience in the world or some measure of flourishing, like you are going to see Paul is imprisoned. He is shipwrecked. You know, he is martyred. John is exiled on Patmos. You know, Peter is nailed to an upside down cross. But so it's like, not like saying like, well, yeah, follow Jesus and, you know, your life is going to be rosy and clean for the rest of your life. But it is to say that when we begin to walk in the ways of God and in faithfulness to Christ, we do experience benefits from that that will not accord with what the world often tells us is flourishing.
I think so often of when Jesus says, you know, anyone who wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. And that is a profound theological truth that we will only fully experience the truth of in the new creation. It's also, and as I was reading around in sort of psychology a few years ago, also turns out that having the posture of love and service toward others versus the posture of pursuing one's own happiness turns out to yield really great psychological results. So it's as so often, the further I go on in the Christian faith, the more I realize quite how true Jesus's statements are, even if at first they seem like super counterintuitive. So I'm reading all these books where like modern psychology has shown that in fact, helping others produces more benefits for yourself than being served. And I'm like, who knew? Who knew other than the modern psychologists? Let me see.
Right. Well, Rebecca, let me ask you this. Would you be comfortable describing yourself as a religious person? Like if I said, Rebecca, are you a religious person?
Yeah, I think it's one of those questions which I would want to say so much more. Because, as I mentioned earlier, to say I'm a religious person is sort of like saying I believe in philosophy.
Sure.
Okay. However, I think because most people would see and legitimately see Christianity as a religion, it would be disingenuous of me to say, no, I'm not a religious person.
Right.
How about you?
Yeah, I'll tell you. Let me tell you two ways. So yes, I'd feel comfortable telling somebody I'm a religious person because I know by that they typically mean, at least here. Now maybe this, when this question is asked in a different part of the world, they mean something different. Here they're typically like, are you involved in broadly religious activities?
Yes.
And in Texas, they almost always mean, are you some version of a Christian?
Yes.
that, like, so that's not probably true everywhere in our country, but here it is. So yes, I would say if somebody asked me, are you a religious person? I'd say, yeah, absolutely. But the way that I kind of answer this to create conversation is I'll say yes. And I think everybody is a religious person.
Mm. And see what you did there.
Yeah. See what I did there? And then, you know, typically they'll say something like, well, I don't really consider myself a religious person. And I would say, well, what do we mean by religion?
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean? And if they say, well, you know, like, and that just, and the reason I say that is not because I'm trying to give you some like rhetorical strategy you can use, but because when we talk about religion, when we do have conversations about religion, and we talk about it too rarely, I really think religion is something we should talk about more mm-hmm. and more openly. And we should feel comfortable to say, tell me about your religion. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to learn. I want to know. Yeah. Would you be willing to share something with me about where you're from or what you believe or how you came to believe that? I feel like we should talk about religion more we do.
Yeah.
But I'll often just try to – I want to create conversation. I don't want to say like, yes, I'm a religious person, period.
Right.
I say like,
end off, yeah.
Yeah, I am. I think everyone is. And create an opportunity to have a conversation. You know, I remember when Tim Keller said – oh gosh, I forget if he wrote this or if I heard him say it in a talk, you know, and Tim Keller is somebody who has spent his life, in a place where, a very different place than Texas. Mm-hmm. And he's learned how to have these conversations in meaningful ways with people that are not identical to him. So I remember one time he said, when people tell me, yeah, I don't believe in God, I always ask them, tell me what God you don't believe in, because maybe mm-hmm. I don't believe in him either.
Right.
And that's such a kind and gentle and invitational way of just saying, like, if we never sit down to really talk about what we're talking about and we mm-hmm. always stay on the surface,
yeah.
then we keep just driving past one another and we never can have meaningful conversations that get to the root of our yeah. genuine questions, which is who am I? Who is God if there is a God? And what is this world here for?
Yeah.
Like, we'll never get to those if we just go, are you religious? Yes. Okay, great. I'm done.
Moving on. Yeah. Yeah.
Moving on.
So. I had a funny conversation a few years ago with some of the other mums at the school that my kids were at. And I was talking with three white American mums. And one of the mums was saying that there was a significant sort of East African immigrant population at the school that we're part of. And one of the mums was saying, you know, I don't know how to talk to the mums who've moved here from, you know, Ethiopia and Eritrea and other parts of Africa beyond just saying hi. And she was sort of saying she would like to actually make more of a meaningful connection, but she doesn't know what to talk to them about. I said, oh, I talked to them about Jesus. I said, you know, a number of our fellow mums, especially those, you know, from Ethiopia and Eritrea, are actually very, very serious Christians. And one of the mums sort of looked at me, you know, somewhat disconcerted and said, well, but what about the ones that are Muslims? And I said, oh, I talked to them about Jesus too. In actual fact, my conversations with Muslim mums who've moved here from Africa, they're delighted to find that I am also a religious person.
Mm-hmm.
The typical conversation I would have with them would be where they were trying to persuade me that they really kind of believed in Jesus too. You know, Jesus is very honored in our tradition, et cetera, et cetera. And then I'm sort of in a space of saying, well, actually, there are some, you know, pretty meaningful differences right. between what we're talking about here. But I've almost never encountered with an immigrant Muslim,
mm-hmm.
Them feeling or at least expressing in any way a sense of, you know, feeling like it was inappropriate for me to start a religious conversation with them. Yep. In fact, they have felt a sense of camaraderie of like, oh, we're on the same page on at least a number of things. And we feel almost the kind of secular environment around us is actually, you know, a little bit hard for us to navigate. So, yeah, and these conversations, I think, I think that would feel very different to, and I have many, you know, Jewish friends who, you know, American Jewish friends who do feel a sense of the oppressiveness of majority Christianity and how it can feel like they're always, you know, shoved to the side and expected to celebrate Christmas and Easter and things which they have principled objections to. So I think it very much can, you know, depend on somebody's particular background. But I agree with you that having more religious conversations, we need to be less worried that we might offend somebody by initiating a religious conversation, because actually they might find it much more meaningful than we might imagine.
I think you're right. So are we better off without religion, Rebecca?
No.
Okay.
Empirically not.
Empirically
and
not.
And spiritually, absolutely not.
I agree. Well, you can find Confronting Christianity on Instagram and Twitter. We're out there. Leave a review on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, and in your review, include a question that you want us to explore in a future episode. We will take those into consideration when we do our Q&A episode at the end of the season. If you want to find out more about how you can get involved or support what we're doing here, and go to trainingthechurch.com/support. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. Grace and peace.